After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. The book is great. I'm a fan of it. And I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it made it into the VMA's gift bag. And you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book on Amazon, of course, or by going to their website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Hey, guys. Anna David here with the After Party Pod. Be sure to check out After Party Chat, where you can see articles about addiction, recovery, all that falls between lifestyles of the sober and not all that fabulous. Though maybe sometimes fabulous, maybe fabulous doesn't even play a part in it. Hard to do a lot with Robin Leach is the truth. Today, I not only have a very special treat for you in the form of a very special guest, but I also have, as promised, the debut of a new segment here. That new segment, it is called House Calls because it features the delightful Laura House, who will be giving us her take on a couple sober expressions, recovery expressions, you know, the lingo, the things people say. None of this is meant to make light of the seriousness of the journey from addiction to recovery. None of this is meant to offend anybody who might think that these are not expressions that should be talked about because of a tradition. This is just, Laura House is really funny. And some of these expressions are pretty funny, worth discussing, I would say. I find this to be the perfect way to do it. That's why I'm doing it. Our guest today is a hilarious and wonderful guy. His name is Jake Fogelnest. Now, Jake has been working a really long time, even though he's only, I think, 34 years old. He started a public access show out of his childhood bedroom when he was 14. It was called Squirt TV. He was that little squirt on TV. And it was so quirky and he was so precocious that everybody started watching it. And, you know, people like the Beastie Boys and Janine Garofalo and all of these people. And then that show went to MTV. And then he had a little period of self-destruction, you know, which we talk about it all. And then he got it back together again. He did some more experimenting. Now, though he sort of claims otherwise, he's the busiest man in entertainment. He has multiple shows on the Sirius Network. He has a very popular podcast called The Fogelnest Files, which is on Earwolf. And he does it live at UCB. He just returned from New York, where he was writing for Billy on the Street. What does he not do is really the question. So we had a great chat. I met him earlier this year, didn't know anything about him, and now, you know, I'm semi-addicted to following him on Twitter. Addicted. See, I worked addiction into it. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy the new segment, enjoy the guest. I hope you will write me and tell me. I do love it when you tell me on Twitter, mostly, but feel free to email me, Anna@afterpartychat.com. Maybe there's somebody you think should be on this podcast. I will listen to you. I like to interview people in recovery from addiction. And I'm sure there are plenty of those people that I don't know about that you do. So let me know about that. Feel free. Feel free. I mean, feel a lot of freedom when it comes to the idea of leaving a positive comment on iTunes or even giving us 5 stars. Why not? You know, being of service to this podcast is good. You. That's honestly the truth. So anyway, thank you for listening. See you next week. Enjoy. Hi, guys. This is House Calls with Laura House.
House Calls.
Today, she's going to give us her feelings about the expression crosstalk.
I have very strong feelings today about crosstalk. Mm. First of all, why is no crosstalk permission to crosstalk? That is bad news.
Okay. Well,
like when you go, no offense, you're like, you've gotten really super fat. No offense. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like,
no offense, but
you
is the
are
worst thing to say.
Offending.
Yeah.
But I feel like I heard it within the past 6 hours of somebody long time.
Yeah.
Said no crosstalk, but, and then it was like, but to the woman who said the thing. And I was sitting there like, you kind of wonder, like, because sometimes people will say something helpful.
Yeah.
Like, no crosstalk, but I totally get it. I went through the same thing and hang in there. Like, right. And it's nice. But this was a little shaming.
Yeah.
What this guy said. And I was, and the woman left the meeting.
Yeah. Oh, that's bad.
That is why there's no crosstalk.
Yeah.
So I'm particularly angry about it today. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm not a mind reader. That's on the list. I'm not a mind reader. She could have left the meeting for
she could have had
any number
commitment.
Of reasons. But yeah. All I know is a guy said something to her that I know and he was coming from a fine place. He wasn't trying to be shit. He was saying, I had a similar experience. I took this action. That part was a little shaming. But I would not have heard that correct. I would not have heard that as being helpful, really, really new. So there's a reason why crosstalk, and I wish people would respect
the
that.
The one thing is when a speaker shares and people, you know, say, oh, thank you so much. I related to this, this, and this. That's okay.
Yeah.
I've seen a crosstalk thing go terribly awry. It's almost a little dark to bring up.
It's, yeah.
But
it's really not funny. It's really kind of terrible.
But I think the confusing thing about the language is that it means different things to different people. Like, I've heard meetings where they say crosstalk is defined as talking while someone else is sharing. Really?
That's
interrupting. I think that's defined as, talking while someone else is sharing.
I just did it.
You just did
I
it.
I just talked
you
over
you. You were so
you.
Talented. She's not only a comedian and a meditation teacher.
I talked right over you to explain
but she,
that version.
She can explain.
Of crosstalk. I'm still doing
by
it.
By acting them out.
Uh-huh.
This is.
One more thing.
She's a multi-talent. We call that a multi-hyphen sometimes.
So I think we've learned, don't crosstalk, A. And B, if you do crosstalk, don't start by saying, hey, no crosstalk, but like own it at least. At
hey,
least be responsible
some,
for your
cross-talk.
Crazy crosstalk.
Yeah. House calls with Laura House. Look what's happening.
Now it's working?
Yeah.
There you go. We got hours to record.
I mean, and here we had brilliance. We had brilliance on tape. We had your original reaction to me telling that fascinating story of meeting you.
Yes.
Lost.
Gone forever.
That's
but you know
so
what?
Tragic.
That's all right.
But I don't like the way, that microphone, it wants to get away from you, kind of like my cat.
Your cat is very cute.
She's beautiful, right?
She's a beautiful cat. I've only seen the one. One
yeah.
is under the bed.
Yeah.
My cat is at my mom's house because I was, I've been back and forth from New York. And
right.
I was like, hey, will you watch my cat? I've been back now for several days. My mom will not return my cat.
Wait, your mom is in L.A.?
Yeah, my mom lives in L.A. now.
She moved out when you moved out?
No, she moved out about 6 months after I moved out. She moved out, I guess, 6 months after.
That's really rare for an older New Yorker to move to LA.
Well, what's in New York anymore?
Nothing. It's awful.
I hate it. What is left for, she took over the lease on my apartment. She lost her apartment. She took over the lease on my old apartment. That lease was up. And then it was just like she had come out to visit and was sort of like, what are we going to do? Get you another apartment in New York City for $1 billion? Or
right.
You'd be here. It's sunny. And she's like, I'm moving.
Right, right.
You know?
And she make, like, lady friends out here?
Yeah, she's got, like, a whole life. It's really nice.
So...
But she's kidnapped my cat.
Right, right.
Can't get it back.
Well, first of all, I thought you couldn't take a cat to a new location because they basically... I mean, Toby goes on hunger strike.
Right.
If I ever take her anywhere else.
Egon, my cat, has gotten better at it. He doesn't mind the location change. Because now he knows the location.
Yeah, yeah.
However, he does not like the transportation to the location change.
See, my cats are different. They think that transportation is super fun.
Oh, I wish that was the case.
Well, but I do it. Well, A, I drive.
Right.
Okay, something insane is happening with Toby. But so what I do, you're supposed to keep them in the little cage or whatever.
Yeah.
And instead I let them roam crazily and right. they love it. But it's not safe. I mean, like they'll be under the
yeah.
break and stuff like that. No, I'm serious. But they yeah. love it so much. How right. can I not indulge them?
Because you're a responsible adult.
Apparently that is not the case. So Egon doesn't like
the He trip. Doesn't like it. He gets really freaked out. He's gotten better at it. Even just getting him into the carrier is an
oh, that's yeah. a horrible. Yeah, yeah you got to sneak up on him.
Yeah, and... it's awful. I hate it.
I know.
But
I know.
But yeah, now he's fine. He's fine. He will be traumatized later today when he gets put into a carrier. But then he'll be fine within 2
right.
seconds.
Right. That's the thing about cat memories is they're really insanely small.
They're kind of dumb cats. Like they're very sweet. I love cats. They're kind of dimwits.
Well, look how small they are. How yeah. big can their brains be?
They're, it's not that. That look, being look, said, they're dopey little things. I'll be honest.
You haven't met Lily. That girl mm-hmm. is a lot smarter than a lot of people I know.
Okay.
She doesn't have command of the English language, but yeah. she is smarter, that definitely, you know, than that certain you know people. Of.
It, that could be...
No, I mean, like, she can open doors. I mean, no, she,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad she's not out here wowing you. That could happen. Okay, but, so, okay, so I was saying that I was introduced to, you know, the person that is Jake Fogelnest in a sort of somewhat backwards way. Of course, in retrospect, I now remember seeing you on... you know, the VH1 mm-hmm. talking head stuff.
But we met in a business meeting.
We met in a business meeting.
Right.
And with a guy who I adore, who I'm seeing tonight, by mm-hmm. the way. And so all he said is, I was in this really busy time in my life, and he said, come in, we're going to talk about doing this podcast. And so all I knew is I was in a business meeting with my buddy Dave mm-hmm. and two guys who were cracking me up. And I'm like, these are uncommonly funny men. Who are these men? And then it somehow came up that we were all sober.
Right.
Okay. That happened. Then I started to become, and it was sort of mentioned in passing, oh, Jake, yeah, he, you know, he was in Wet Hot American Summer. And I'm like, that's weird.
For 10 seconds.
Okay,
though.
I know yeah. that's hardly like the big exciting thing from your resume.
Yeah.
And yet that's, again, it all came backwards. And then I started to understand that you have, you know, have this long comedy career that started when you were 12 years old.
Right. I was like 15.
Okay.
And I was in New York and I had this public access show, which, you know, let anybody do a show on public access. And it was sort of a talk show that was started in my bedroom and it became very popular. And then eventually became like, then I did a Comedy Central special and it became an MTV show. And it was just like, you know, the start of everything that I've done. And it was uncommonly young.
And what gave you this idea? You just were precocious and had opinions.
I think... What happened was my father moved to New York in like 1985 or 1986,
mm-hmm.
and New York cable blows. I lived in Philadelphia with my mother at the time, and New York cable blows Philadelphia cable away.
Right
at the time, and I remember very distinctively the day that the cable guy came in. With this brown box with buttons that you push, you know, like physical buttons. And he was like, hey, you know, for like $500, we can make it so you get everything. This blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like you could, when you could bribe the cable guy.
I loved that era.
Yeah, that era does not exist anymore.
No.
And so my dad did.
Yeah.
And so we got everything. And like that meant like HBO and everything, which like in Philadelphia, the original cable that I had was – I had a box and it had a button on it and it was television, just the major networks, NBC. I don't even think there was even Fox yet. And then you switched it over and you got HBO. That was what I had
right.
for cable.
Right.
So I was blown away. So I have access to HBO and all of the amazing cable channels. And what do I land on that is the most interesting to me is public access television.
Right.
Which at the time in New York City in the late 80s was insane. And I saw, wait a minute. This is not real. This can't be clearly anybody that wants a TV show can have a TV
right.
show.
Right.
And as a young kid... That was very exciting to me. It was also the same time that I was like seeing the John Waters movies for the first time.
Right.
And it was just sort of like, oh, anybody can just do this. Like if these people are doing it,
right.
then I can do it and I can do it now. So by the time I moved to New York City with my mother when I was 15, it was like 1993, 1994. And, you know, I had all those years of being like, yeah, if I move to New York, I want to do a cable access show. And I just did it. You know, I'd always been interested in, you know, doing that kind of stuff and comedy and things like that. So there was an opportunity, and I just saw no reason why I shouldn't start.
And so you just recorded it, and then it went on.
Yeah, you recorded it. I would record it on a. I saved up one summer and bought a Hi8 camcorder, and I would edit it between that and the VCR, and then I would take a VHS tape, and I would go to 23rd Street and give it to the cable access people, and they'd be like, "Thank you very much," and then they would play it on television.
That is insane.
It is insane.
Especially, it still goes on.
It definitely still goes on. In fact, you know, Chris Gethard, who's a really good friend of mine, he, you know, Chris has been a UCB guy, for a decade, still is, and got cast in the lead of a Comedy Central show called Big Lake, which Adam McKay produced, and it was with Horatio Sanz and Chris Parnell. It was a funny show. It didn't last. But, you know, this was a guy who's working in television and movies, and he's like, you know what, fuck it, I'm doing a cable access show. And he started one, and he's still doing it, and it's wildly successful. I think now they're going to try to actually turn it into a real show. And so, but for him to do it in this age of the internet, and they live stream it too, and they put it online. For him to do it in this age, it was kind of funny. But the reason why he did it is because they have access, like if you sign up and everything, you know, it's community access. They have cameras and a TV studio like that you can just use. So he does a live show. They take calls, and you know, it's a resource that is available to people,
and
but
underused,
but also going, it becoming sort of more and more obsolete as we all have the equipment that they have on our cell phones.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, no, it's just a great tool to use, and I just used it. That's all I did.
And so then, how quickly did you understand that people and sort of high profile people were responding to it and that kind of thing?
That is where just an incredible amount of luck came into it, because it was almost immediately.
Right.
It was within weeks of the show.
That's so crazy.
Starting that, because I had a voicemail number that I would leave the voicemail number up on the bottom of the screen the whole time, and I could get voicemails from people. I think the mailbox held originally 50 voicemails. I then made a deal with the voicemail company where it could be unlimited.
Right.
And to pay more.
Right.
But of the 50 voicemails, it would be like the guys from They Might Be Giants or Sonic Youth, and just very much the things that I was excited about and talking about. They were home on Sunday night, and they were watching.
Did you get to pick that it was on Sunday nights? No, that was just...
You didn't. You got to suggest, like, I would like these time slots. I don't remember what time slot I originally wanted, but Sunday night at 12:30 became an important thing in when it was on.
Right.
Because this was an era where people still flicked through the channels.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like, that was, you don't do that anymore. A guide comes up.
Right.
So people would flick through the channels, and I was on channel 16, which was four away from MTV showing 120 minutes. So people would flick away from the commercial of 120 minutes, on me playing something. They would land on like what they thought was just a show that was maybe playing a Devo music video. That video would end, and then I would pop up, and they would be like, What the hell is this?
Right.
I'm interested now.
Right.
So that that was it became important that that's when it was on, and it was also the time the year that it was on, just what was going on in New York and pop culture at that moment. It was definitely a of the moment thing.
And so we're not going to dwell on it, but everything started to happen very quickly. You were a child.
I'm a child, yes.
And you're making deals with MTV. The show gets moved to MTV, and you basically start to self-destruct, go to your head,
Yeah, both of those things, and even before, you know what I mean? Like when you are a teenager, I think you are filled with an arrogance that you never quite get back as an adult. And that can be a very good thing, And it can also be the worst thing in the world. And that is why teenagers are awful. So, so what happened to me, it was just like, I just sort of developed this attitude. Well, of course people are watching.
Right.
Of course. Right. Why wouldn't they?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, you look back on that now and you're like, what? But, yeah, no. And even if I did not have a television show that was seeing success, some success as a teenager, I was a teenager living in New York City in 1994. And I was a teenager that grew up with a certain kind of parents and in a certain type of atmosphere where just sort of like there was this attitude of like, we know you're going to be a bad teenager, but don't be too bad. And
yeah,
there weren't sort of, and there was just, so I had the arrogance that is wonderful of being a teenager and the terrible stupidity that comes with it.
Right, right, right. And I think also when things come easily, especially when you're not like a developed human being.
Yeah.
You just think, of course, you're special. I mean,
this
if
is
it happened
how it
to
will
me
be.
Right now,
yeah,
I'm just one of the chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
People are really interested, so, and I'm only 17,
yeah.
So fuck all them.
Exactly.
You know, I
exactly.
mean, I could definitely understand. But yeah. the thing is, but you don't seem like you'd have been a bad kid, because you seem like you were just this, like, precocious, brilliant, you know, close, you know, you love your parents, you know.
Yeah. You know, and I don't think I was a bad kid. I think I was a bad kid only in the sense, I wasn't a bad kid. I think that I had a gene of, I think I had a disease.
Yeah.
You know, I look back on it and other than that one sort of, you know, chromosome or whatever that was off, I was okay.
Right, right, right.
You know, I was definitely cynical. I was definitely opinionated. I was definitely a smart mouth. I am still all of those things today. That's just who I am. And those are good things about me. But I think that I had a predisposition, to drugs and alcohol. And
did you know that then?
No,
nobody talked about it.
No, I didn't understand what even physical addiction meant.
Right.
It seemed like something that stupid people got into.
Right, right.
And,
right.
and I had no understanding of that. My parents are not addicts or alcoholics. They, you know, my mother doesn't do anything. My father smokes pot the way that, quite honestly, I think most people in their 60s should smoke pot. You know, it's, you know, I don't mean to say, you know, there's some people who absolutely shouldn't smoke pot, but he's, you know, he's one of those guys, one of those old guys.
I always hated pot, but yeah.
Me too.
So if they are in their 60s and they and there's someone who can handle it, how should they smoke pot? Like pot once a week? Like,
I think it really depends on the person.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I am very, you can't smoke pot all day. Like the people that smoke pot all day, I don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to deal with
it. Unless it's Doug Benson who manages to remain totally sharp. And
that, I mean, as I was saying that, there is an exception to every rule.
He's the only one.
But I think that Doug, who is just the nicest, most brilliant, funny man, I think that Doug has created a career and a lifestyle for himself that, like, yep, I'm the only guy who can do this.
Really?
And also, he's got a work ethic that's
pretty
amazing.
Well, and also, because I was earning my KDAC at UCLA, which I am super, I'm a dropout.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay. I don't even know what that is.
Oh, what that is it's becoming certified to become a drug and alcohol counselor.
Oh, okay.
And I don't really want to be that. I just thought it would be really interesting to have that education.
Sure.
Anyway, one of the things I learned is that the brain does not stop forming if you're a woman until you're 22 and if you're a guy until you're 25. And I've heard Doug Benson say he started smoking pot at 26.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
That is really interesting. Yeah. No, that you know,
yeah.
And there's these guys like, you know, like I'm skeptical of Kevin Smith, who
is he
guy? Started smoking later in life, and he started smoking. He talks about it, starting to smoke on the set of Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
Right. Oh, that's late in his career.
And how it's been this motivating factor. But then what comes with it is like, I'm not making movies anymore.
Right.
I'm just going to do podcasts. and which I think it's like, that's funny. And I think that, you know, but he waited late in life. And
yeah.
I don't know. It's sort of a, it's sort of a joke, like, that goes around, like, oh, yeah, pot's been great for you.
Right.
But then again, he did make that movie Red State, which is unlike anything that he's ever done, and actually is, like, quite good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's like you're getting kicked off of planes for your weight and stuff like that, so, like, maybe life isn't...
Look, he wears a lot of hockey jerseys, and that's his thing.
Yeah. You know, by the way, I did start listening to his podcast, because I'm not, like, a natural mm-hmm. Kevin Smith person. Like, that's not...
Really? You seem like you would be, like, so into the Viewisk universe. Seems like such an inviting place for women.
No, but, like,
I don't mean to shit on Kevin Smith, but it's definitely dudes
but,
like that.
But I also, I actually literally, because I used to be on G4, mm-hmm. say, and that was, like, a big, and I just was like, I don't even understand it.
Right.
Like, I've tried, and I don't understand it. And then I got to know Jason Mewes a little bit, and I started listening to the podcast, and
his Kevin Smith. Fascinating, yeah.
Yeah. But Kevin Smith, he's so sweet on those podcasts. It made me sort of adore him.
He's been so nice to me over the years. I like Kevin.
He sure comes across as a nice guy.
Yeah, he's genuine as it gets. He's a good Jersey boy.
So okay, and so what were you? Do you not want to talk about what you were doing? Like, when you were experimenting?
I've talked about that stuff so much. Basically, all of the drugs that you could do,
right? Which in New York,
in the 90s,
in the 90s was everything.
So I don't think it takes a brain surgeon to figure out.
Cocaine happened.
Yeah, cocaine happened. That was not my favorite. Mm-hmm. I wanted to shut my brain off and feel no feelings. And there's opiates. There are great drugs for that if you're interested in that.
Okay. Opiates. Okay, yeah.
So that was, you know, what was going on.
Right.
And
how did you start? You just found it?
You just find it. Yeah. Yes, you just find it. And if you're not informed about what it can do to you, and you're like a cool, and I'm using that in big air quotes,
right,
like New York kid,
right,
you're gonna make a really bad choice.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and I think what happens, there's two things that happens with people that get involved with opiates is they try it once and they go, this makes me puke and it makes me feel awful. But it feels great. But I'm never going to do it again because it's too good. And then there's people that are go, oh, well, why can't I just feel this way all the time?
I'm entitled to that.
Yeah,
you know?
I deserve that. I was in that category.
Right.
And, you know, I think that you can, I think you can sometimes be a functional drug user. I'd say about 2 years. Like about two
That's
years.
That's a long time hard drugs.
To use hard drugs. Look. Those 2 years are going to be hard. You're going to be lying.
Right.
You're going to be miserable.
Right.
You're going to be a thief. You're going to just be the worst human being in the world, and you're going to feel terrible about yourself. But you can go 2 years.
You had youth on your side.
Oh, youth. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, when I got into the coke, it was, there was no...
Coke is different.
But yet there are people I know of that have been functioning coke addicts for like 20 years.
Yeah, they're jerks.
But how do you do that?
They can't be good people.
I
am one of those people who's been very, very lucky that the desire to use has been lifted.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends of mine that is not the case.
Yeah.
But I look at all of the, first of all, I just look back at all of that time and all of that drug use. It's disgusting. And I'm sort of, ashamed if I've ever presented it in a public way as like, that's cool and that's a part of who makes me who I am, and you know, Lou Reed and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah,
shut the fuck up. I you know what I mean? And I would often use that as a defense mechanism with people to just be like, look, I'm cool, yeah, that happened, but it's all good now. And
right.
That is so lame.
Right.
And the only reason I like, if I was in any other circumstance, I wouldn't be talking. I've stopped talking about that.
Right.
Because we are specifically talking about recovery and all that stuff.
Right.
I'll talk about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because you were worried it came across as callous, or it just isn't interesting.
First of all, I just don't think it's interesting.
Right.
It's not who I am today. It's not a reflection of my soul and who I am today. It's off-putting. It's just not me
mm-hmm.
anymore. And I don't want anybody to get the impression, that, that you can go through that and it will be okay because people die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and so I don't want to be another one of these guys like, yeah, that's a part of my story, man.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's a part of my story, but like, why don't I be, if I am going to talk about it at all,
yeah.
Why don't I be the guy that's like, yeah. William Burroughs, it's great. Sure. You know what? Don't do it. Like, right. Not in a just say no way.
Right.
But in a like, all right, you want to know about it. Here are the actual consequences.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because, you know, I have this website now. And so one of the things that I do is I look for stories all over the internet about drugs and addiction and recovery. And literally just every day there's probably two. It's like ex-Creed singer talks about his road to recovery. Like there is really like, not one musician.
Yeah.
Who, but at the same time, the reason I keep talking about it, now I'm concerned it's very off-putting. That word will like resonate in my
head.
No.
It's off-putting if you're somebody who is, presenting themselves like, yeah, man, I was a 15-year-old cool dude in New York City. Yeah. Bah, bah, bah. Anyway, let's talk. Let's do bits. That's off-putting.
Right.
That's, and it's also not who I am.
Right. Right. But I don't think you've ever come across like that. I mean,
I worry that I have, and I don't think that I have, but I can look back at stuff and be like, what am I doing that for?
Right. But I think that for people who are struggling with it, how nice it is to know that, you know, because I remember struggling with it and going, okay, so I could kill myself.
Right.
And that's pretty much it. Like, I didn't understand that there was a life after it. I didn't understand that life would be appealing.
There is no light at the end. When you get to that place where there's no light at the end of the tunnel, that is an awful place to be.
Yeah.
It is a scary place to be. It is a place that I work really hard to make sure that I never go back to again.
Yeah.
But, and that's where it got better for me is when I always come back to the word of acceptance. When I sort of accepted, I'm not going to die. I am actively, short of actually killing myself, which I can't do.
Right.
Okay? Everything that I'm doing, all of my behavior would lead me to be a dead person.
Right.
And it's not happening. Oh, God, I'm going to be one of these people that has to struggle with this forever.
Right.
So, all right. So this is not working anymore. My God, I've got to find some way to live because I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
And once I sort of accepted that, then it was just like, oh, God, how am I going to find a way to live?
Right.
Luckily, I found one.
And what happened? I mean, how long were you doing drugs and all that?
I have two bouts. When I was 17, I got sober for the first time.
Uh-huh.
I was scared straight.
Right,
and what happened was it's like, you know, everything came kind of sort of crashing down. I was sent to a rehab facility that was not like Promises Malibu cushy thing.
So like hardcore,
yeah, it was
scrubbing toilets kind of thing.
Yeah, it was that and yelling at you.
Yeah.
It was an awful, awful rehab.
Yeah.
I think it has been dismantled.
Yeah.
It is a method of recovery that is
like shame based
and ineffective and really kind of messed me up.
Yeah.
But it scared me until I was about 20 years old to not do anything. And then if you stop using drugs and alcohol, your life will get better. It's just, it will.
Yeah.
Nobody's life has ever gotten worse because they stopped using drugs and alcohol.
Right.
So what happened was when I was 20, I sort of took a look around. I'm like, hey, everything is all right. I can have a drink.
Yeah.
And you know what? I did that pretty successfully for about 7 years.
God, I thought you were going to say days.
No, for about 7 years, I drank.
Wow.
You know, I look back on it now and I go, oh, yeah, no, I was a mess. You know what I mean? But it wasn't disaster bottom time. What unfortunately it did was it flipped the switch and it allowed everything to kind of come back. And by the time I was 25, 26, that's where it started to become a problem.
Just alcohol, though.
No alcohol, and then drugs came back.
Yeah,
in the picture.
Yeah.
But from 20 to 25, it was just alcohol. And then when I was 27, I was really in bad shape. You know, I was really in bad shape. 27 is a hard year for people, you know.
Jesus year.
Yeah, it's the Jesus year, and it's, you know, it's...
Wasn't good for me.
It's not a good year. And that's when a lot of people die. And
yeah.
I was basically what happened was I hit a bottom. There was no rehab the second time. There was no intervention. There was just simply, I am exhausted and I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And
were you doing it all alone? Did you have party pass?
No, like, I was definitely
shame.
Yes, the alone. This thing of like, you have to cut all these people out of your life. You know what I mean? I've had to do that. There's some people I've cut out of my life because in sobriety, I have found, oh, you're just not a person that I, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't party with people.
Yeah.
I was very much alone.
It's kind of amateur to party with people if you're an addict or an
alcoholic. I think so. I mean, I don't mean to make a joke.
Take your drugs. No, but I'm serious. Yeah. I mean, like, it's just like they really. I couldn't get serious about it until I was fun.
I mean, and I wasn't trying to socialize or have a good time. I was literally trying to not feel anything.
Right.
I was trying to shut down any feeling I had, good, bad, whatever.
Right.
So what happened was, thank God, you know, this is why I don't hate that rehab experience that I had, because it put the seed in my head that there was a place where I could go. So I went to that place.
Yeah.
We all know that place.
Yes.
And I was just very much like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And it's the easiest thing. They say, you know, well, why don't you try some controlled drinking? So I did.
Oh, you did try that. They're not really even serious when they say that, but go on.
All right, so I went out and I said, I'm going to have two beers at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
I failed so miserably at that, so spectacularly. The next, you know, morning, I said, well, that didn't work.
Right.
And that was it.
Oh. Oh, so it just took one night of controlled.
Yeah, one night. I said, oh, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
I get it now.
Yeah.
I get it. And then that was when I had this sort of moment of like, okay, now how do I, now what?
Yeah.
Now how, which is terrifying.
And so you're still 27 at this point.
Yeah, I'm 27. And that was, you know, my last drink.
Oh, and wait. So, but how old are you now?
I'm 34.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got confused by the tenses I was using. Yeah. I was like, okay, so, and you've stayed sober since, I've so nine, sober. I can't do math,
but seven.
7 years. Yeah. I really can't do math.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what do, when you said what now, what have you found has been effective in terms of helping you to live differently?
Talking to, other alcoholics about the disease, that has been the, number one thing, is just sitting here and doing this and making sure that, you know, remembering that I'm
different
every day before anything else, that helps. Finding some sort of spiritual connection with the world has been enormous. That does not have to be God. Like, the thing that really helped me was when they were just like, you just imagine something greater than yourself.
Right.
Surely there is something
right.
in this world
right.
that has more power than you.
Right.
And, you know, when I thought about it that way, I was like, yep, okay, yeah. I'm not, you know. When I found out that I wasn't in charge of the universe, I can't tell you what a relief it was.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not in charge.
Yeah.
Fine.
All this time I thought I was.
I am not a religious person.
Right.
You know, I you know, but just finding some aspect of like, I am not in charge was good.
Did you grow up with any religion?
No.
None.
No. I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
But
emphasis on the ish.
Ish. Yeah. Emphasis on the ish. I wasn't bar mitzvahed.
Right.
You know, it just wasn't important to us.
Yeah.
You know, it just, and I am fine with that. It's okay. But, and I didn't actually struggle that much with the spiritual side of the thing.
Right.
Because it
right.
was such a relief. Also just acceptance, you know, accepting that like, okay, if I do this, it sets off a switch in my head. So let's not set off that switch.
Yeah.
If I was, you know, it's an allergy.
Yeah.
You know, that was really, really helpful. And, you know, there's, you know, step work, which has been good. And just, you know, when I first got sober, I was very, very much one of those people who was every day, sometimes twice a day, in there trying to, you know, just trying to live, just trying to figure out a way to live, which I think is a, which is what you should do.
Right, right. And were you sharing a lot? Were you listening a lot?
Both.
Were you okay?
Yeah.
And you know, because you've talked like several times about how, you know, your using was about escaping feelings.
Yeah.
What do you do? I mean, yes, there are the steps, but what do you do to handle those feelings now?
I'm so happy and blessed now that I am at a point in my life where I want to feel the feelings. Right. I don't care if they're the, I want the bad ones. I want the good ones. I just, I bring it on. I really have this, this great place that, that I've gotten to over the years, where it's just like, all right, whatever the feelings are, I'm okay with. What do you, you know, I truly believe, and I might be stupid, but God bless if I'm stupid, that I don't think anything is going to be thrown at me that I will not be able to handle.
Right.
There's just nothing.
Right.
What could, like, I start to think of the worst thing in the world, and it's like, I will get through.
Right.
I will manage.
Right.
How did I get to that place? Clearing the wreckage of the past. I go to therapy every week.
Right.
I'll go to therapy later today.
Right.
Talk therapy is everything.
Big fan myself.
It's you just to process stuff, to process this stuff from the past. I stopped worrying about things that happened 10 years ago. I stopped worrying so much about what's going to happen in 10 years. I was able to find a place of like truly being in the moment and, and living in the now, which is very difficult for some people.
Very difficult for me.
But I, you know, I'm in good shape with that. You know, I got there through letting go of resentment. You know, and making sure that when resentments are there, also like looking at my own behavior and like something's not working in life right now. Something is not working in a relationship, in a job situation. What is my part in it?
Right.
Learn. I never did that before.
Never occurred to me.
It never occurred to me. And that's where I think it's a disease.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how does it not occur to you to look at your own behavior in something?
Right.
Oh, because you're a mental patient.
Right.
I'm putting that in an extreme way, but like you're a mental patient.
Well, and I used to think also, I really delusionally think, I misspoke, but it's kind of accurate. Like I will think when I'm pissed off at someone that I'm really punishing them. That like my being so angry is hurting them.
Yeah. No, it's and it's hurting.
Yeah.
Usually not hurting them at all.
No. Unaware of it or they're like, oh, that poor angry woman.
Yeah. I have, you know, and I am still working on this and I will work on this forever is dealing with my anger and resentment. And that is a constant struggle. And also realizing that like, you know, and when it happens and when I you know, I just had sort of like a huge breakthrough with this stuff. And I'm sort of looking back on like this huge breakthrough where it's like, oh, but I've done that before. I've let go of this anger and changed the way I behaved with another person in my life before. Of course, with this person, why didn't I see it? You know what I mean? So then I feel bad and
right,
but I don't wallow in self-pity about it. It's just sort of like, all right, great. From this moment on, I'm changing my behavior. And I'm not going to get it perfect all the time.
Right.
But I'm going to try. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that we really do change our brain chemistry at a certain point. Responding in a different way does change the way you're going to respond ultimately.
Yes. It becomes easier and easier.
Yeah.
It's a muscle that gets.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but like doing the step where we write down like all of our resentments. I mean, for me, it was, and every time I listen to a sponsee do it, it's like, oh, I had five scenarios over and over and over again. I may have had 200 people that I listed, but it was really, it's the same five things.
I found it to be a very humbling, almost humiliating experience because it was just like, you write all this stuff down. You're so angry.
Right.
And then you go through it and it's just like, all right, you're angry about that? Well, what's your part in it?
Right.
And you go, oh, and then a lot of times it's like, you're still angry about that? You want to stop being angry about it? Like, it just was like, when you actually do that, it's sort of like, yeah, you're right. You know what I mean?
Well, what's funny for me is I can't do it like in talking. You know, I just had a thing with my sponsor the other day where I was pissed off about somebody talking to me and telling me a sort of, well, you know, you're doing that for the wrong reason. It was like a friend who got super shamey with me.
Right.
And I was so angry, and I was telling my sponsor, and she said, well, oftentimes, you know, this should just be press play on a sponsor's list of right. all-time quotes, but it's like, oftentimes when I'm angry at somebody, it's because it's something that I do, and it reminds me of them. And I was angry at her. I was like, no, I'm an Al-Anon. I don't do that stuff. And then she's like, well, maybe you want to look at it. And I felt convinced she was wrong until I started writing about it.
Right.
And then I remembered, oh, I do that.
I'm starting to realize as I get older that everybody is a mess.
Everyone's really a mess. Are.
You know, and I don't, I would look and compare and it would, I'm never jealous of anybody's success. You know what I mean? I really am not.
Really?
I'm not, because I heard long ago that, like, you know, there's plenty of success for everybody.
Yeah.
Which I believe, you know, yeah. There is plenty of success to go around for everybody. Somebody else's gain is not my failure.
I know.
It's hard to
remember that sometimes.
And also I'm a smart mouth, you know?
Right.
And if I don't like something, I just don't like something. And I like, and a lot of my humor comes from, like, that's garbage, you know?
Right.
But I forget what my point was, but I went through like a whopper recently. It was just like, oh, I had a lot of resentment that I thought I was giving up, and I had a lot of anger, and like, that's all on me. It's not on, you know, somebody else. It's all on me. And, I want to try to stay and remember that. I want to, you know, I look at that as a big moment in my life now of like, oh, you have to, you know what I mean?
And it's also the thing when you think you've let it go.
Mm-hmm.
How about that one?
Yeah, that's
you're like, I've totally let it go. And then you realize, you know, you're still angry about something from 9 years ago or whatever it is.
But you know, this is what, everybody's a mess. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Everybody has, like, if somebody, I may look at someone and think they have it all put together, and who knows what hell is going on in their head or their personal life. It's like everyone, no one has it all figured out.
Right.
No one. I you know, and that's okay. That's so comforting to me. But makes me feel less alone. Makes me feel less of a freak.
Do you think that, but you know, for alcoholics, it's harder because it's sort of a disease of perception?
You know what? No, I don't think it's harder for alcoholics. I think everybody has, and I think that there's this misconception about alcoholics, like from other people, that like, but like, oh, they have their secret club and they can all talk to each other. And it's just like, you know, no, I think everybody has things in their life that it is really hard for. They might get overwhelmed by their emotions. They might not have to deal in the workplace. I think everybody is struggling. I don't think that we get to like a special badge.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just because we deal with disease. You know, somebody dealing with cancer has hard. I think that they're having just a hard time as we are. I think perhaps even harder.
I would say.
Yeah. I would say perhaps a lot harder.
Right.
So I think that at a certain point, it becomes sort of a responsibility. I do think that there are some people who can't be helped, you know, and that's very sad. That's where I believe it's a disease, and some people die from a disease, you know, and, you know, but if you are a sober person, I actually think it can be dangerous to be like, I'm special. It's harder for me than other people. Right. I get a break because of this. It's like, no, you don't.
Right.
You don't.
Right.
You know, I that's a little game that we can say to ourselves.
Right.
And that's very nice in our meetings sometimes. It's like, you know, but like at the end of the day, it's like, no, you have to be a human being like everybody else and get along in the world.
So when somebody says, well, of course I reacted that way, I'm an alcoholic, does that annoy you?
Yeah. It doesn't. Here's the thing. It would annoy me if that was the end of it. If they weren't changing, they weren't working to change the behavior.
Right.
If they weren't, you know what I mean? But people that like, oh yeah, no, I know what's wrong with me. And that's the excuse for the behavior that never changes.
Right.
That's sort of like, okay, it's great. I'm so psyched you're that self-aware and understand why you're messed up. So you still going to be messed up, or right, are you going right, to you right. stop being messed up?
Do
you, I have compassion, though. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, and some people can't be helped, and some people get sober and can't be helped, can't get out of the misery, you know?
Yeah, that's horrible.
It happens, though.
Yeah.
You know? Do you hang out with a lot of sober people? Is that your
plan? I have, you know, sober people in my life. I have probably a lot of sober people in my life. I also, you know, hang out with normal people.
Right.
I don't hang out with any drunks or drug addicts. And the reason why that is because they're awful to hang out with. They're very boring, or they're evil. And, you know, I don't have anyone in my life like that.
Right.
I have a lot of people in my life that will go have two glasses of wine for dinner.
Right.
I will have people that every once in a while they have a crazy night. You know, I have people in my life that don't drink or don't do drugs, and it has nothing to do with, they just don't.
Yeah, how about that?
That you know what I mean?
Never heard of that till I got sober.
It's out there.
Yeah.
I have people in my life that are deeply in recovery, you know, that and I love those people. And I have, you know, people in my life that, you know, are a mess, but aren't
not because of drugs.
Not because of drugs or alcohol.
Issues because other than alcohol.
Other reasons. And and you know, I try to have all kinds of people in my life. I think that's good, you know.
But would you say the comedy scene? I mean, if it used to be rife with addiction, it's rife with sober people now.
My two closest friends, it really is. My two closest friends that I would be drinking with, they don't drink anymore.
Right.
You know, they don't.
Right.
We can't.
Yeah.
Not like we used to.
Right.
And I will say that all of that drinking contributed to none of the comedy, nothing creative. It just was actually a giant waste of time.
I know, right?
So don't think like, I got to go out and be drugged to be funny. Like, actually don't.
Yeah.
I don't have regrets of the past, but I do in the sense that like, go to bed.
Yeah.
Go to bed. It's 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I had a lot of fun for a long time before I had a lot of not fun for a long time. But I used to believe, you know, towards the end when it was really dark and I was writing all alone, I thought I needed cocaine. Because I couldn't. And then I thought, I can do it with red wine. And then when I got sober, I was like, I can do it with cigarettes. And then it became, I can do it with coffee. And you know what? I actually don't need anything.
Right. That's right.
Sometimes it's still hell.
Oh, yeah. Cigarettes are hard.
Do you still?
I don't smoke anymore. I'm trying to not smoke. I'm trying to not use nicotine lozenges. I got off the cigarettes and I was on the nicotine lozenges for a while. It's still a battle that I am going through. But I am so, it is the last thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't smoke.
Until you get on I gotta quit sugar thing. Then those people drive me a little crazy.
But I don't, but I sort of have done that sort of voluntarily. Like,
oh, really?
I don't, I just like, I was just like, I don't need to, I never was a coffee drinker.
Yeah.
I don't need to drink all of this Red Bull.
Right.
It just sort of like that I've had less of a hard time with.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just, I think that's just moving to LA. Honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I do not get going from cigarettes to the lozenges and the gum and all that stuff.
Oh, like I do.
I smoked a lot, but I mean, I did it for the, I loved the ritual.
Yeah.
I mean, forget the nicotine.
I was less into the ritual than I was actually into making sure as much nicotine got into my system as possible.
Right.
I want the drug of nicotine. It creates this false sense of alertness. Focus. I've only recently started to realize what nicotine as a drug was doing for me.
Yeah.
And it was doing a lot. It was giving the sense that it was doing a lot.
Right.
But I mean, and I still, it's a battle.
I mean, I'll tell you, caffeine is more effective in terms of alertness than nicotine.
I know, you know what I mean? But there's a, you know, that's why, you know, it's a fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so what are you doing these days besides everything? You have a show. Well, this will not be timely for mm-hmm. listeners. This last week, Jake had a show at UCB on... Is that true?
What did I do last week?
I am posting this next week. Look at how on the ball I am. So, but you have a show tomorrow night is what I'm saying, right?
Tomorrow, last week.
Yes, exactly. And it was successful as hell.
Very successful.
Biggest success UCB ever seen.
I booked all the guests for it and cared.
But is that your podcast that you're doing?
You know what? Yeah, I do my podcast, which is just really fun. It's called The Fogelnest Files, and it's just basically like I've amassed sort of this knowledge of pop culture and the internet for 34 years, and I pull things from my brain and that sort of rich history, and I pull clips, and I have a guest in, and I use those clips as a means to have a conversation with
right.
them.
You feature three guests?
When I do it live. Okay. I will do it live once a month, usually at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. I just did it at the Bell House in New York. Uh-huh. And that'll be more of like, yeah, it's a fun panel of comedians and right. stuff. And you know, I'm doing that. Yeah, I'm doing those. I haven't been able to do those for a while because I was in New York writing for Billy on the Street all summer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So while I was there, it was just me and guests and a microphone. I wasn't doing any live shows. But then I went and did the show live at the Bell House. So it's like once a month I'll do an episode where it's like, let's have a panel and just fuck around in front of
right,
an audience. Yeah.
Right, right.
And so I'll do one. It's fun. It's a fun night.
And it's on Earwolf.
Yeah, it's on Earwolf. Yeah.
And it should be weekly, but it's hasn't weekly. Been. Oh, it is always
no,
weekly.
It's always, no, okay. it's always weekly. When I was in New York writing on Billy on the Street, I put out an episode every week. I have so many.
In the can
at this point since I got back to LA, just because it's sort of like, sure, let's do it. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
And really interesting. You know, I talk to everybody. The criteria is I just got to be interested in the person.
Right, right, right.
So it's like everyone from Jimmy Fallon to I got Don Bowles, who's the drummer in the Germs, a punk band, him coming up. And then Andy Richter is just on the show, Judah Friedlander. It's just like, you know, so it's comedians and people that I'm interested in. It could be this guy. I had this guy, Jeffrey Schwartz, on, who is a documentary filmmaker who – you know, did the great HBO documentary on Vito Russo, the uh-huh. guy who did The Celluloid Closet, and is a great gay activist. And he also directed a documentary on Divine, the John Waters movie uh-huh. star. And so I had him on, and I got him Paul Scheer. You know,
right,
it's
right,
like,
right,
it's
right.
you know, not that Paul Scheer's not the best, but just like,
right, right.
you know, you're LA comedian people, and then the
right.
weird people that I just want to talk to.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard, and you had Paul F. on, I know.
Oh, yeah,
I've
Paul
heard
F., yep.
And so are you writing on shows? Are you?
Yeah, I was writing on Billy on the Street, this summer.
Bi-coastal.
I have been, I'm not anymore.
You
I'm
want
back
to
here.
Be a LA person.
I love New York.
Right.
It's not cold there right now. So
right.
when it's cold, like, I love New York. I love LA too, you
right.
know? And so this is home. I live here. When I got off the plane after being in New York for 6 weeks for Billy on the Street, I was like, oh yeah, I'm home. And then I've been back and I'll go back there next month for like a meeting and everything. But like, I am an LA resident who has been very fortunate to get
right.
to spend some time in New York
right.
this year.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And wait, I had something so important to say, and it just immediately left my head.
That's
I've
okay.
gone not to my questions. Look at all the highlights I have
you
about
have
your life.
You've highlighted. You've done highlighting.
But, oh, yeah, what about all these radio shows?
Oh,
Are
yeah,
they
yeah.
still current? You
yes.
have something on Sirius right now?
Yes, I'm probably on Sirius right now.
At
I have a wonderful job with SiriusXM Radio where I am on two channels just playing music on the radio. I'm just a DJ, and I'm on a channel called SiriusXMU from 6 a.m. to noon Eastern, and then a channel called Alt Nation from noon to 6 Eastern. It's all pre-recorded.
Yeah.
I go in for about an hour every day and
pick the songs?
I don't pick every song, but I'm – because that would be impossible. I would have to program 12 hours of radio
right.
a day. But I do get to be like, let's play this all the time. Like, I have, like, great, like, freedom to do that. So, I rarely take advantage of it because they, it's like, what am I going to play, the Rolling Stones on the alternative rock channel? Like, my personal tastes are usually ancient. But I have this job and I go in and record and sometimes interview bands and stuff. And it takes about an hour a day. And it's just a great gig.
Yeah. How did that come about?
After I did the public access show, I worked at K-Rock in New York. Or after I did the MTV show, I worked at K-Rock in New York when I was 17 and did radio. And it was great. For a couple of years, I had a show Sunday night where I did play wherever I wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was just a fun, crazy show. And then a new program director came in and said, you have to play what we said. And I quit because I was 20 and stupid. Mm. And then a couple of years after that, I think I was about 24, 25, a buddy that was a DJ at K-Rock, and then he was like, you should talk to this guy, Rob Cross.
Oh, he was my boss when I had a show at Sirius.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Nicest guy ever.
Yeah, he said, you should talk to Rob Cross. You know, he's looking for DJs. And I was like, I don't want to do that, man. That'll be a drag. And he's like, Rob is different. You should go meet with him. And I met with Rob, and Rob he just gets it. He's the nicest guy. Yeah. He's the greatest. And he's hired me. And then before any of us were like famous, we're just messing around at UCB. He's like, your friend Paul Scheer is pretty funny. Why don't you guys go on the radio at like night and just do some talking? You got to play music, but talk more.
Right.
And Rob was like, gave me the opportunity to do that. And it was really fun. And then Howard Stern left and made the announcement that he was going to Sirius. And just like, we're all getting fired. And that was like, you know, very crazy time in my life. Rob got hired at Sirius.
Right.
I stayed behind at K-Rock getting increasingly more furious because I knew that I was going to be out the door anyway and just screwing around.
Right.
They, in the same day, I was suspended for talking crap on the air. And then offered my own talk show on the new talk channel because the radio business is stupid.
Right.
And I said, oh, this is all going to, you know, Howard Stern, basically it was announced that David Lee Roth was going to be taking over for Howard Stern. And that was when I knew. I said, oh, I'm going to be unemployed in 2 seconds.
Right.
So I called over to Sirius, to my friend Ross Sapin, and started making a deal with them. And I stayed at Free FM doing a talk show with my friend Jackie Clark for about 6 weeks.
Right.
Then I went to Sirius. That was about 7 years ago. And my boss over there now, who I work with and have worked with for years, is Rob Cross.
Right.
So it's the best job. It's the best people. Here's your other cat, Lily.
Lily got excited hearing about Rob Cross.
Yeah.
You know?
He's a great guy. And like Sirius has been it's a great home for me. Right. And they have been so generous with just the freedom that they have given me. I had a job in New York and I said, I could do this from Los Angeles, right? And they said, yeah. So I moved here.
Yeah.
And nobody, if you listen on the radio, you have no idea probably that I moved. But like, I was able to move that job here.
Yeah.
And if I'm in New York, I can do it there.
Yeah. No, that
honestly,
is my
I could
idea.
Do it from my phone, you know, I really could.
Right.
But, you know, but so they've just been great.
And, okay, here is what America wants to know, or what I want to know. This Barksy thing.
Yes. It's a great joke that I came up with.
So you made a joke last week, 2 weeks ago?
I started a revolution, let's be honest.
Okay, and the revolution is known as Barksy.
Basically, it's a really great joke. I'll tell it. First of all, you need to be familiar with the street artist Banksy.
And who isn't?
Okay, so if you're familiar with the street artist Banksy, the joke works a lot better.
Okay.
It's just a much better joke. I think it still works even if you don't know who Banksy is. Okay, so if Banksy was a dog, he would be called Barksy.
Yeah.
That is the joke.
That's the joke.
I came up with it. There's a lot of people who are trying to take credit that they came up with the joke Barksy.
What happened? You put that joke on Twitter.
I put the joke on Twitter.
And then...
Basically, I put the joke on Twitter and it was like what if Banksy was a dog? He'd be called Barksy. Now I just sit back and wait for all the retweets to roll in, and people started retweeting it, but then people started writing the same joke on their Twitter feed to mess with me.
Right.
And look, I'm the originator of the Barksy joke. And,
no, you should claim that.
There's other people are scumbags.
And then
I started tweeting about how great the Barksy joke was.
Yeah, that's where I caught up with it. And I was like,
my favorite in that is like, I started tweeting just like randomly, just like, I wonder if any celebrities have heard the Barksy joke. Bruce Springsteen, Constance Zimmer, Thomas Edison, and Constance Zimmer's like, yeah, I've heard on the real Constance Zimmer on Twitter's like, yeah, I've heard the Barksy joke. I was like, all right, thank you, Constance Zimmer. She likes it too, I think.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't?
And why wouldn't? But just a random list of, so like, what does Bruce Springsteen and Constance Zimmer have in common?
Thomas Edison, though.
He and Constance Zimmer have
everything in common. But okay, yeah, no, my Twitter observations are, besides that that's a great joke, is that you're obsessed with Andy Levy and Natasha Lyonne is obsessed with you. And I've been trying to get to the bottom of it just in my own house.
Okay. Natasha is one of my oldest friends.
Right. Okay, that I figured, actually. Yeah.
Andy Levy is human garbage. No, Andy Levy is a guy that I met via Twitter.
But you've been on Red Eye.
I have been on Red Eye.
Because I used to do Red Eye a ton when I lived in New York.
Yeah.
You met him on Twitter.
We met on Twitter. He asked me to come on Red Eye.
Yeah.
And I've done it a couple of times. And I've done it when I've been back in New York.
Like this summer, did you?
Yeah, I did it a couple times this summer. I wish I could have done it more.
He your profile photo on Twitter?
That's right. Andy's my profile photo. We just got it. We just have a banter back and forth where we bully each other.
Yeah.
And
a bit homoerotic.
It's funny and great.
I don't follow him anymore, so I can't.
Why not?
Did you
have a fight with Andy Levy?
No. Maybe. It doesn't matter. I've done Red Eye 30 times. A lot.
That's a lot of times.
A lot of times. Too much, one could say.
Right.
Especially when I have no business talking about politics.
Yeah, same here. And they just have me on to so I can be an idiot.
I think I had
the idiot position.
Yeah, no, I had the leg chair, which is officially, I think, what they consider the,
that
you
makes
know.
Sense.
But yeah, no, there was an incident. Yeah, I don't know. I follow Greg.
I don't know Greg. I don't follow Greg, actually.
Oh, interesting.
I know
Interesting.
Greg. Andy's my friend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and every once in a while, people are like, why do you hang out with why do you engage with this Fox News guy?
Well, he's
like,
a libertarian.
He's like he's pretty progressive, actually.
Right.
He's not part of that whole thing.
Right,
and,
right.
And he's just a good guy. He's just a good guy. It's Twitter. It doesn't matter.
It means everything.
It's the
How
dumbest
dare you?
Thing.
Well, okay. I feel like that's everything.
Okay, great.
I mean, unless
we figured it out.
We figured out the key to life.
We cured alcoholism.
We did. Congratulations. Well, really, it was Lily.
Right, Lily.
Obviously, look at that face.
Oh, hi.
As if she couldn't cure alcoholism.
Oh, my God. Look at that face.
So people want to find you.
Mm-hmm.
You're everywhere. So The Fogel Nest Files is on Earwolf. They can find it on iTunes.
That's on Earwolf and iTunes.
And watch Billy on the Street.
Yes, which you should do anyway. It's the funniest show.
I'm ashamed to say I haven't seen it.
I was a fan of it before.
I hear it's hilarious.
You will love it.
Whenever someone retweets Billy Eichner,
Billy's.
It's always hilarious. So I don't know what I'm doing with my life. And what else? Where else can they find you? Books? Radio?
I'm on
covered
the radio.
Where's your book? Where is the Jake Fogel Nest story?
Here's the thing about that.
Yeah, don't do it. It's a terrible business.
There's that.
Yeah.
I know I could write a book.
I'm sure you could.
I don't want to write the book about me. Look, I know that if I go right now and I write a book, I had a crazy 90s, especially with all the 90s nostalgia going on. I could write that book.
Yeah.
I could sell that book and stuff. And it would probably really benefit my career. I don't want to.
Yeah.
And I'm being a baby about it. And I understand that. But I just want to put out new things into the universe.
Not revisit.
I don't want to do a story about, oh yeah, the show, blah, blah, blah. I'm sick of it. And I have so much other stuff. You know, you know, I wish I had an idea for a book about something else.
Right.
I just don't want to write a collection of humorous essays about my wild 90s.
Right.
Am I stupid? Probably.
No. I think the collection of comedic essays is, you know, there's too many of them, frankly.
Yeah.
Even though I have
But I could sell out. One and I'd get paid. You know what I mean?
But what if you did it more as a memoir instead of a...
I don't want to write a memoir.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad. It would be a good book.
I'm being a baby. I understand.
So are people coming after you? People have asked you?
I've had opportunity. Yeah, I've had opportunity. You know, nothing like major.
Right, not like
Simon and Schuster banging down my door. Right. Like, please write a book. You know?
Right.
But no, there's been opportunities that I could take that I just, when I sat down to really think about it, I didn't follow up on it. Would I like to do more writing? Yes. But I know I'm wrong.
I don't think you are. Here's why. You know, I'm on the eve of my sixth book coming out.
And my bitterness is exploding. Right?
No, but I think if you didn't have so many other things going on and so many other sort of exciting facets that are far more rewarding on a number of levels, financially being one of them probably, then you would be being stupid. But I think you're right. I think you have a future to live rather than a past to revisit.
I would think a book deal would be a little bit more financially rewarding than a podcast, but
you would be surprised.
Yeah, I don't know. I hear what you're saying, but I do. I'm always looking at sort of my laziness and my fears, and like, should I just do that? You know what I mean?
You do not seem lazy.
I feel it. I really do.
But do you think that's sort of alcoholism?
You
know, that sort of like, you know, thing on your shoulder that's like, you're not doing enough.
Maybe. I think it is also, you know, I think maybe I have a resentment about this. I think that my alcoholism, and I hate to hear this even come out of my mouth. I don't want to use it as an excuse, but I feel like I've had to go slowly with stuff.
Right.
Because the sobriety does come first.
Right.
And I am someone who gets over, you know, where there'll be other people that go overwhelmed by other things. I get overwhelmed by career stuff, and I have to be very careful of that with me. You know what I mean? I always feel like I could do more. I'm better than I was a year ago. I'm certainly better than I was 2 years ago. I see improvement, but I still feel like I have ways to go. But I'll talk about that at therapy at 4 o'clock today.
Well, I'm incredibly jealous of your career, if that helps, because I have not worked through my jealousy issues. No, I mean, I listen to it and I'm like, you have so much going on. Whatever voice is telling you, whatever, it's not true.
I think it's the appearance of having a lot of things going on, but there's actually not that much going on.
No, it's a lot. It's a lot. Okay, you have been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Sure.
Okay, I'm stopping.